Hello, this is Jim Clementi, and I'm very happy to be hosting this special interview episode of Locked Up Abroad, where I'm interviewing the one and only Billy Hayes. How you doing, Billy?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. I'm really excited to talk to you and to get to know you a little bit. Your experiences are amazing. I listened to the episode, and I was very moved. Obviously, it's still, even all these years later, very raw to you what happened. And if you don't mind, I'd like to get into a little bit of that.
Sure.
As a behavioral analyst, I study human behavior, and we see the behavior at its extremes. I'm sure some of what you did.
Prison is an interesting place to study human nature, absolutely.
And you're forced to, right?
Yeah, whether you like to or not. Right, for survival. You need to know what's going on with the people around you and the people inside you, which is more important.
Wow, yeah.
I got kind of lucky. I got in a fight the very first night in jail, which, you know, I'm not real big, but I used to be very fast and nasty, and I did martial arts, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, turn the corner. If you want to find somebody to kick your ass, just look around. There'll be somebody. But because I got in the fight the first night, and this guy was somebody semi-important in the jail, he went around with this swollen face and a black eye for a week or two. And that kind of helped my reputation. Yeah. I didn't know it at the time because I got dragged to the cellar and had my feet beaten, which is a form of punishment throughout the Middle East called falaka, bastinado, that's very effective. Yeah. It's very effective. But it actually helped my reputation in the jail. People were like, you know, well, maybe we won't mess with this guy. Let's find somebody else.
So the bottom line is you decided to go to Turkey and bring back some hashish, and you were successful three times.
Yeah.
And three times kind of emboldened you. Unfortunately for you, things happened in the real world that changed everything.
The PLO had blown up some jets out in the Jordanian desert, increased airport security, etc. I knew that. I mean, I'm not a fool. The day before I was scheduled to fly out, I went out to the Istanbul airport to watch people getting on the plane. And I didn't see anybody getting searched at customs. I thought, fine, you know, piece of cake. I can just do this again.
On the fourth attempt, you got all the way to a bus leading out to the airplane.
After the first attempt with the cast, I taped it under my arms after that. Second trip, I got on the Istanbul Express and took the train from Orient Express. Took the train out of Istanbul to back to Europe. And the third time, I just taped the hash under my arms and walked straight on the plane because I knew nobody had ever touched me. That's what a fool I was. And the fourth time, I did the same thing. Again, if I had gone up on the deck and watched people getting searched at the airplane instead of customs, I would have dumped the hash or taken a train or something. But
there was
an English girl studying belly dancing in Istanbul at the time who'd love to show me her latest lessons. And I went back to her, again, following my nuts instead of actually following my mind and my head and watch people get on the plane. I wouldn't have been busted.
Yeah.
Not there. I would have been busted somewhere else because I just, you know, was running forward. And again, not thinking about consequences.
Right.
My first reaction was to deny reality. My first thought was, this can't be happening to me. This can't be happening. I'm too smart and good looking to ever get arrested. That's how stupid I was. I really believed that.
Well, at least you were good looking, right?
Yeah, that helped a lot, especially in jail. But I really believed that. And then suddenly the reality of, holy shit. And, you know, I tried to kind of like balls it out and bluff my way onto. I couldn't get back to the airport. I couldn't unstrap this hash taped onto my body. It was just bluff my way onto the plane. Right. And I got close. I went past the first cop and I slid past the second cop and I was putting my yoga book back into my shoulder pack. And I kind of pointed like the first cop got me. And
to make it look like he had
already searched. Yeah, because there were two cops on each side. And I was like, I've already been searched. And he wasn't sure. There were so many people and so much confusion. And I got one foot up in the air towards the boarding ramp. When this hand grabbed my elbow, it's like, ah. And that cop looked, and the first cop just happened to finish with a passenger and catch my cop's eye, and he nodded like, did you search this one? And the first cop looked at me, and he shook his head no, and the grip on my elbow tightened, and this nervous young cop pulled me aside. You know, they're out here looking for terrorists. They're not looking for hash smugglers.
Right.
And I've just lied to him. So he pulled me aside. He said, gestured, lift your arms, which I did, and this guy started to search me. And the first thing he hit was these hard plaques under my arms.
And he said, boy, this guy's built.
And he kept going. Yeah. It's like, what? And he hit the hard plaques taped to my belly. I'm pretty skinny, so they didn't show much. And he kept going down my legs. That's where, I found myself praying, you know, please, Jesus, get me out of here. I'll never do this shit again. But I'm in a Muslim country. I'm praying to the wrong God. And this time when the guy came back, he hit the hard plaques under my arms, and he froze. And my heart stopped, and I could see it in his eyes. Mm-hmm. He freaked out, jumped back, pulled out his gun, dropped to one knee, started screaming, Bamba, Bamba! And all the soldiers put their rifles down, and people were screaming and collapsing on the ground. And I just stood there, my hands in the air, not breathing, waiting to get shot.
Wow.
The cop put his shaking gun into my stomach, and it took him a moment. He lifted up my sweater, and it took him a moment to realize that it's not hashish, but... I mean, it's not a mad bomber wired with explosive, but some idiot smuggling hashish out here. I could see it. The look on his face, I could see the tension go
back.
He said, hashish. And then he yelled at the soldiers, hashish, hashish. And everybody was so relieved, and they all put their guns down, and the people got off the ground. Everybody was so relieved except me.
Yeah.
It was the start of a very long 5 years.
Well, and then the next night was your first night in prison, and we heard about that
the beating,
the episode. Yeah. I mean,
that was a bad night.
Yeah. And do you know why they choose to beat people in their feet?
It's a form of punishment throughout the Middle East. It's called falaka, and it doesn't leave as many marks. And it's just for some reason, it's very prevalent. Again, not just Turkey, but all in the Middle East. Luckily for me, they were just teaching me a lesson, which is a new guy. He's in prison. It's his first night, and he's in a fight. Let's teach him a lesson. And it's a very effective lesson, because in jail, if you and I got into a fight and the guards caught us or found us and I was bloody, they'd beat you equally bloody. If they caught us and you were bloody, they'd beat me equally. So there's no way to win if the guards catch you. So fighting in jail is pretty much a lot of yelling and a lot of posturing, or a lot of very quick, nasty violence that you want to get away from as soon as possible before the guards come in.
And how did you learn that about the sort of the rules of the game when you were in prison?
Well, there's rules of the game. Here's how it's supposed to be. And here's the way it really is. And you quickly have to bridge that difference, because in between is a no man's land you don't want to be. And I discovered the first night about the rules about fighting and such, because I did get beaten. And I discovered afterwards that actually that was kind of a good thing for me, because people looked at me. Again, I'm not real big. But it's like, that's the guy who beat up Ziad. I keep changing the name between the book and the film. Ziad was his name. That's the guy who beat up Ziad? Really? And so it's like, if they're looking for somebody to mess with, like, maybe we'll just find somebody else. Because there's always somebody easier. It kind of helped me in jail. In fact, it did. It helped me a lot in jail.
So you found yourself at the bottom of the pyramid, and right in the first night in a fight, and then being beaten badly.
Right.
But in the end, somehow you survived. How did you manage to do that?
I'm pretty lucky in a lot of respects. I'm healthy. I've got some pretty healthy Irish genes. I don't have a lot of bad stuff in my body. I discovered yoga just before getting arrested, and I've literally done yoga every day for the last 50 years. Yoga saved me in jail. In prison, you have no control over anything except yourself. And yoga helps you maintain your physical body and your emotional self, and puts perspective on things. Right. And in jail, everywhere you need it, but especially in jail, you need that perspective as to why am I... Got a lot of time to think in jail. I was running so fast and not stopping on the outside. Prison slowed me down, and I could ask questions like, why am I here, in this body, in this room, in this metaphysical place, in this world? And you think a lot about this stuff, and at least I did. And I needed to think about it. I needed to get some perspective on life that I didn't have, because life was so easy for me. In prison, you so have to be on guard to not allow all that negativity around you to get in and or to sour. There's
well, it's like a filter, right?
Yeah, but there's so much in the air in jail. There's so much sorrow and anger and bitterness in the air that it seeps in. And when it gets to your center, you lose something. Prison takes something away. I mean, you get stronger and harder in ways because you have to, or you get broken in ways.
Right.
And sometimes you get so hard that you seal off from the world. By a lot of people coming out of jail, they can't relate to people anymore or to life anymore. They've got this kind of barnacle crust around their emotions, because that's what you needed to survive prison. I discovered I was getting to the point in jail where something was going to harden in a way that I would never be able to change, or break in a way that I would never be able to fix. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I mean, I'd always been trying to get out. From the first day, I was planning to escape. And I tried a couple of times, and I went to the madhouse to try and get a crazy report. And then I was setting up another escape, and my best friend in the world came to help me, and he ended up getting killed out of this whole thing. And that's when I realized I just need to stop this. I've already, not only have I messed up my own life and, of course, in my family, you know, daily pain, to know that my mom every night, I can't even talk about this 50 years later, but then when my best friend died, that's when I realized, you know, I'm just so fucking selfish. I'm just going to stop. I'm going to spend my time. This is when I had a 4-year, 2-month sentence.
Right.
And I was able to count off 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, that kind of stuff. And that changed everything. Once I stopped trying to escape and trying to get out, I was able to stay in the moment and mm-hmm. be within myself in prison. And prison changed completely for me. Who's it? William James. People can alter their lives by altering their attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And I altered my attitude in jail when my friend died and I knew I had like 2 years left or a year and a half. My dad kept saying, you know, don't do anything stupid. You know, spend your time. Don't make things worse. And that all made sense to me after my friend died. I said, fine, I'll spend my time. And that changed everything. It literally changed the day, changed where I was, because internally I wasn't scrambling to get out. I was able to appreciate sun shining, there's birds in the air.
Yeah, nobody's
beating my feet today.
Right, the fact that you were alive. I have to ask you this. How do they sentence you to 4 years and 2 months and then increase it to life?
Because,
it's the same crime.
Well,
didn't you already get sentenced?
Yes, I did. But my sentence had never had the tustic, the official final. There's a bunch of courts in Istanbul. The final high court has to stamp it. And they never stamped it. And meanwhile, the U.S. government and Nixon were pressuring Turkey and all those other foreign countries to increase their drug penalties, which they've done, to our detriment right now.
So twice now you've been the victim of political change.
Yeah, I was the victim
right
of myself being stupid as the biggest victim. But yes, that political change came straight from the U.S., pressuring Turkey into increasing their penalties. And Turkey did. I mean, there was a big political incident. Turkey said, fine, you want to see us increase our drug penalties? We will. And I was the first American to receive the life sentence. Wow. Unfortunately, not the last. A couple of women, a couple of guys. They just started showing that we're hard on drugs.
I'm sitting here talking to you. You're an intelligent man. You obviously have experienced a lot in life.
Right.
But you convinced yourself at a young age that you were invulnerable. And other people, the reason why I want to go into this is because it's a cautionary tale.
Sure.
Because when you're at that age and when you have a certain set of experiences, you do feel like you can't be caught.
At the very least, my life should be a cautionary tale. I was lucky. I was 23 when I got busted, 28 when I escaped. Sort of at the height of my physical prowess, and you need to be healthy in jail because if you're sick, you're prey, P-R-E-Y. And emotionally, at 23, I was old enough to maybe be able to handle this. If you're younger, if you're 18, 19 years old coming into jail, it's hard. Or if you're older, prison is hard.
I'm sure many of you are listening from your cars right now. That's where I do most of my listening too. And one of my favorite ways to pass the time and hear amazing stories is through Audible. Audible has the best audiobook performances, the largest library, and the most exclusive content. Lately, I've been listening to an amazing book, The Devil in the White City, by Eric Larson, narrated by Tony Goldwyn. It follows notorious serial killer H.H. Holmes and architect Daniel Burnham, two men whose lives took very different paths during the lead-up to the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Right now, my listeners can start a 30-day trial and get their first Audible book free. Learn more at audible.com/lockedup. That's audible, audible.com/lockedup. Bakakoi. That was a clever plan on your part. Tell us about it.
Bakırköy Mental Hospital in Istanbul. It's a huge hospital, a huge sprawling grounds. It had, I think, like 14 different individual big building facilities among these rolling hills and stuff. It's been around there for hundreds of years. One of the places, supposedly, in the way it looked like to me, I think it was true, the scuttlebutt was that this was a barracks for the Sultan's Janissary troops back during the Ottoman Empire.
Wow.
And they used this as, and it was a separate walled, there's a big wall around everything, and then a lot of separate units, and this unit had its own separate wall around it, big old crumbling gray wall with rusty barbed wire on top. And that was Section 13 for the criminally insane. Mm-hmm. And everyone in there was there because they were criminals and they were totally insane. But what I discovered is there was an article in Turkish law that says if you're judged to be crazy, mentally incompetent, they can't keep you in prison. They don't send you on the street if you're that crazy. They put you in Bakırköy. But right. Bakırköy, I know, had to be a better place to escape from than the prison, Samadjula, that I was locked up in. So I arranged with the prison doctor. Bribery. Everything works on bakshish. I became friends with the prison doctor. Friends is, he talks to me every week or two when the American consul comes out. There's a carton of cigarettes and he gets it, blah, blah, blah. And after a while, the prison doctor and I have this rapport and I'm telling him I'm having terrible dreams and I can't think and I used to be a writer and I can't put words together and I really need some help. And he takes some money and I get sent to Bakırköy for 2 weeks of observation where I wanted to convince them I was crazy so they would keep me there. And all of my college friends would have said, no problem, you're convincing people you're crazy, until I got there and saw the competition. And I realized, oh my God, this is... The movie...
They set the bar pretty high.
Yeah, the movie made a lot of different changes in the story. You know, again, brilliant film, and Alan Parker's a great director, and Brad Davis gave his heart and soul, and the music was good, but they made some basic, big changes in my storyline. Mm-hmm. One of the things that everyone said, well, they totally must have made up all of that crazy house. No, actually, that was as accurate. Alan Parker, I've heard him doing an interview, he said... He went and actually went to a madhouse on Malta where they filmed Midnight Express. Uh-huh. He said, I wouldn't do it now because I realized it was just, it was so exploitative, but it so worked because the people, the visual, and they had a couple actors mixed in, but they had these other people who were like insane. Wow. And Bakırköy, that was insane. Mm-hmm. I was there a couple of weeks. I could talk about it forever. It was I've been a lot of strange places in my life, nothing ever even came close to comparing to Bakırköy. When I left there after a couple of weeks and got back to Samadjula prison, I came back and the first thing when I walked in was like, oh, it's so good to be back here.
Really?
All my friends are looking at me like, the fuck are you talking about back here?
So said,
you
really
haven't been to Bakırköy. Everything is perspective. I thought things were tough in the United States because, you know, I turned on my water. Where's my hot water? You know, I'm an American. I'm a New Yorker, goddammit. Where's my hot water? Bathe out of the sink with a plastic pitcher once a week with hot water for 5 years, you appreciate turning on a shower.
Right.
Just taking a shower. Little things that you just take for so much for granted in life. I took everything for granted. It's like when you miss them, I would have in the middle of brutally hot summer nights with sweat and mosquitoes, I would wake up tasting cold applesauce. Mm. I'd have killed my grandma for cold applesauce. Or tried.
Not really grandma.
She was a tough little lady. She'd say, come on, bring it, take it on. But for cold applesauce, oh my God. Little things that you just take for granted in life.
So let's get back to the island.
Okay.
At some point, you ended up on the island. Can you tell us what that was about, how you got there?
Yeah, after Samadjula, the big major prison, and then out to Bakırköy, the crazy house. What I discovered was that when my sentence got changed and the High Court in Ankara officially gave me the tasdik, the official notice, I was now legally eligible for transfer to other prisons. And I'd learned that Imrali Island Prison out in the Sea of Marmara, about 26 Ks, about 17 miles, 26 kilometers out into the Sea of Marmara, was an island prison that, again, I'm a lifeguard and a surfer and stuff. I just knew one way or the other, if I got onto that island, I'll find a way to escape better than the lockup. The Istanbul prison was
But you could actually pick a particular prison?
You can put choices in for a variety of prisons.
Really?
And see the prison doctor, my good buddy, the prison doctor. My dad came and actually visited me after my sentence got changed when he realized, you know, he'd been telling me for years, don't do anything stupid. Don't make it worse. You know, do your time. Once I got the life, reduced to 30-year sentence. He knew the switch is on.
There was nothing stupid after that.
Yes, and then, right. And I'm, you know, I'm not going to sit there the rest of my life. And he actually brought me a photo album that he'd smuggled. He cut the back out of a photo album and pasted 27 $100 bills into this photo album and gave them to me in a prison visit. I mean, my dad could have been busted and in jail with me. I so admire mm-hmm. him. And I used that money to bribe people. You need everything for bribe. And part of it was the prison doctor. He got me out to, actually, it took 18 months and 3 false starts.
Wow.
But eventually, I got sent to Imrali Prison Island. They chain you up and they put you on the ferry boat. And a couple of hours, you're out on the island. And on that island, I was the only foreigner. But, you know, I speak pretty good Turkish by now. But I also knew that one way or the other, I'm getting off this island. It's 17 miles to the mainland. The sea was considered to be the wall around the prison. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you work there. It was a prison island. The boats would come from the mainland bringing produce and such. And we had a canning factory, and all the prisoners worked, and you moved around a little. Locked up at night. You still got your barracks, like, set up. You're locked up, and there's, you know, your night check and bed check. But it's so much more open than Samaja Law prison, and you get to be out in nature. And, you know, I was carrying these 50-kilo sacks of beans and fruit up from the boats up to the prison factory, back and forth. And I was working. You know, these guys are saying to me, Yavash, slow down. Why are you working so hard? It's like, no, I'm a sport man. And I was wanting mm-hmm. to get really hard and healthy again. And I had told all of the people on the island when I got transferred there that the American government was, you know, sending me here. And yes, I've got a 30-year prison sentence, but the American government's going to work something out. And they're sending me out here and I'll get transferred back home. Because there was the talk of a transfer treaty that started out when my sentence got changed. It took about another 3 or 4 years after I escaped, but eventually it got put in place and is still in place.
Wow.
Prisoner exchange treaty allowing Americans in foreign prisons to be repatriated and do the remainder of the sentence here.
Wow.
And foreign nationals to go back home. So wow. That was in the air to some degree. And that's what I told everybody. And they all believed that the American government, first off, none of them could believe that I got 30 years for 2 kilos of hash. Are
right.
you kidding me? But that's, you know, that was the story that kind of covered me. So they knew I'm on the island. I'm an American. I was kind of like a curiosity piece because I speak good Turkish. And they want to know, does your father have a factory back in New York? And, you know, Turkish workers, can you bring us back? So I just played along with it, just knowing that one way or the other, I'm going to get out. And the boats that come to the island, none of them spend the night on the prison island.
Right.
Because it's a prison island. They have to go back to, unless, as I discovered one day, a storm out at sea is so much that the boats have to anchor.
And that's what I want to talk to you about, because prisons that are on islands like Rikers Island and Alcatraz,
I've been to both of those places.
Yeah. they're there because the waters are so turbulent around there on an everyday basis that it is so risky to try to escape. And you picked a day when there was a storm.
Right.
It was too dangerous for the boats to go. But that's the day you took. So you kind of glossed over that. You were rowing for a while, but I mean, I'm sure you were on a little dinghy.
Desperate men do desperate things.
Right, so tell us what that journey was actually like.
I was so desperate at that point. Again, I was at the point where something was hardening in a way that was not going to ever change or break in a way that was not going to fix. I needed to go one way or the other. I'm either free or I'm dead. I was not getting caught. That I knew.
Right.
They're going to shoot me and kill me or I'm going to get away. But the only time that the boats spend the night on the island, and each boat, by the way, has a little tiny dinghy tied up behind it. There's the key here.
Right.
And once I saw that, the first time a storm came and I realized, wow, the boats aren't leaving the harbor like they've done every other day. They're staying, and there's those little dinghies tied behind them. So I knew if I could get out to the dinghy, again, I'm a swimmer. That's not a part. If I get a dinghy, I get to the mainland. Too long a story, but I was able to get myself set up so where the night bed check, I could be beyond it, be out and not be counted. There's a group of kapodais, they call them what would be the term? Gangster prisoners. The guys who really run the jail.
Right.
Wealthy guys, they run the jail. They would meet at night down in the accounting shed. You know, we can things all day long, and then there's two nerdy guys with adding machines that towed up the canning profits. And in that shed, all of the big gangster prisoners would come down there and smoke joints and drink Rocky and play domino. Oh, whatever they want, play dominoes and such. And I initiated myself into, which is what I would do in most situations in jail, find the bad guy, the toughest, strongest, the leader guy, and kind of make friends with him if you can.
Right.
or if you have to, hit him in the throat, but better make friends with him. And then people don't mess with you because you're friends with the tough guy. And on the island, I just found the number one guy, and he instantly became a friend of mine. I speak Turkish, I'm a curiosity piece. I think he had thoughts of, you know, what else could he get from me? And I let him think whatever he wanted and just kept playing around. And I got to be able to be in the accounting shed at night after the night bed check. So I knew nobody's going to know that I'm really
good. That was your window of opportunity.
Exactly. And I was down there, and I stayed a little while, and I told them I didn't feel good. And they said, here, have some hash, have some rocky. No, thanks. I got to go back to the barracks and sleep. And instead, I made my way down to the harbor and hid under this overhang thing and kind of like timed the guards who patrol out there. It was raining, so the guards weren't really on there. And I wanted to swim out to one of these boats and steal the rowboat. But I knew that I needed to get pretty much straight across about 17 miles to the mainland because the current is pushing me this way, which is why my right hand got bloodier from pulling the oar to try and correct it.
Right.
But I knew I needed to get pretty much straight across to the mainland or else I'd be washed south because the current sweeps down from the north down to the Dardanelles. So I need to keep across.
Wow.
And I used the lights of the island. At first, the horseshoe. So as I moved away from the island, if I'd lose the lights, it means that I've drifted too far south and I would try and pull the oars back. And after a while, I lost the lights completely and I'm totally lost out here in the raining.
But I mean, how big were the waves? You're
pretty
going up
big.
And down, you're losing the island every couple of seconds.
Pretty big. They were like choppy and rainy and such, and then a whole series of big swells started coming through.
Yeah.
And that's when it scared me to death. But at the top of one of the swells, I could see far off in the distance these tiny red blinking lights. At least I thought that's what I saw. And I was heading towards them. And I was so exhausted, but I would, you know, I'd row 1,000 miles, man. I'm free out here.
Right.
I was 28 years old. I was in such good shape, and I was so motivated. And eventually, I rowed and rowed and rowed and rowed all night, and I just eventually, suddenly, the boat scraped down on the sand, and I came up, and it scraped down again, and I looked up to this rising darkness and saw this wild, rugged coastline and realized, I made it, and the sun was coming up, and the storm was passing, and everything was good, except for the fact that I could look out across the water and see Imrali Prison Island, and I know the clock is ticking, because they do a morning bed check. And I'm going to be missing. This is 1975. There's no internet. There's no fast commute. This is Turkey, 1975. It took them a while to actually get the word out that I was missing. They found the boat. Somebody reported, the guy on the boat reported his rowboat was missing. And in the morning, hours later in the morning, somebody on the shore found the rowboat, which was, I pulled it up on the sand. You know, a friend of mine said, why didn't you sink that rowboat? So it was like, I love that little rowboat. That rowboat got me across here in the storm. Love that little boat.
That's an indication that emotions...
It was a mistake.
Yes.
It was a mistake. Well, I've had, a couple of mistakes here and there, like the cast not realizing I needed a doctor's note.
Yeah. But even so many times, as unlucky as you were on that fourth time to get arrested, so many times you were so lucky.
When I'm hot,
so many
I'm really hot, and when I'm not, I was so not. And then I got lucky again. There was so many little, if it went this way, as opposed to the guy in the boat, when I'm cutting the rope, looking, spitting out the window, he spit over me into the water. If he looked down,
he would have seen you.
I'm dead.
Right. And then when you were crawling up the hillside on the other side.
Yes, the two soldiers patrolling the top of this ditch. If one of them saw me, I'm dead because I'm not letting them take me. I'm running and they're shooting and I'm dying, but I'm not going back to jail. Mm-hmm. That's one of the good things about being past the point of no return. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have said, well, you must be frightened to death. Yes and no. I mean, fear is, it is what it is. It's how you deal with it. And for me, the fear was there, but it wasn't a sort of a debilitating, like I can't act, because it was quite the opposite. It's like, I'm going, and I'm not
well,
stopping.
Well, to me, that's the mark of courage. Actually.
Well, that's what courage is not letting your fear stop you. Because if you're not fearful of a lot of stuff, you're a psychopath or an idiot. You should be afraid
courage,
of a whole lot of stuff.
Right. Courage is action in the face of fear. And obviously, your fear was well-founded.
Or doing the right thing morally, which is even harder. Because I'll leap off tall buildings and I'll sweep things. But making moral choices sometimes is tough, like getting married. The smartest thing I ever did was getting married. But also the hardest, like commitment. Oh, no. I'll smuggle hash. I'll jump off buildings. I'll swim. But commitment?
Really? Somehow I just don't get that from you. I don't know.
Getting married was the best thing I ever did. Not the easiest thing I've ever done, but I've been married for 36 years.
Wow.
I met my wife at the Cannes Film Festival when Midnight Express premiered there.
Really?
I mean, of all places in the world to meet somebody real, the height of Hollywood hype.
What is it like now that you've had a movie about your experiences? Not totally accurate, but at least documenting your story, locked up abroad. And now you've actually done a documentary, haven't you?
We've done, there's a documentary that's out there right now. In fact, it was at the Cannes Film Festival in
May.
What's
it called?
It's called Midnight Return, The Story of Billy Hayes in Turkey.
And
it's really, Sally Sussman Marina is a writer. She's won a bunch of Emmy Awards for Young and the Restless and such. And she always wanted to do something else. And I was at her house. Her husband and I went to acting class together 30 years ago. And I was at their house one night, and I mentioned that I'd always love to go back to Istanbul. She looked at me like, what? Because she hadn't heard all the stuff where, you know, the world only knows of my story through, if they do, through the book and the film Midnight Express. Mm. That, both of them start at the beginning of getting arrested on the fourth trip. I couldn't talk about the first three trips, certainly not in my book. I wanted to. But my lawyer, when I got back, he said, let me get this straight. So you want to write about the fact that you made three smuggling trips successfully to Turkey back to the United States before getting arrested on your fourth trip. Is that correct? I said, yeah. He said, well, just one more question. Are you out of your mind? You can't say that. It was 1975. It was the height of the drug. I said, they can't prove it. They don't have any proof. He said, they don't need to prove
it. That's an admission.
If you tell the U.S. that you've done this, Turkey is going to ask for your extradition here at some point, and it's going to be up to the U.S. government. You want to stick your nose in the air or tell them you smuggled three times and what are you going to do about it? You can't say that. So I couldn't write about that, which meant that the book, my first book, Midnight Express, second book, Midnight Return, I'm able to write about it, but the first book, I couldn't write about it, and the film was based upon the book, and they took their own liberties, but you don't see a single good Turk in the whole movie, Midnight Express. It was my problem with the movie, because I had Turkish friends. I had a Turkish girlfriend. I mean, I'm not talking politics and Greeks or Armenians and stuff. That's different. Just the Turkish people. I quite like them. I loved Istanbul. It was the city of my boyhood dreams. I'd made three wonderful trips there. I'd spent weeks in Istanbul, but I couldn't talk about that, and that didn't come out in the film. And so when the film came out, Turkish tourism dropped 95%, and to this day, they're still dealing with these images from the movie Midnight Express, and I have obviously some responsibility in that. The courtroom scene where they've in the movie, they've got me, my character, speaking to the court between getting my sentence changed and now suddenly getting resentenced. I had a chance to speak, and I know it doesn't matter what I say, because when I finish, they're going to sentence me to life in prison, which they did. But I wanted to affect these people, and they had my fate in their hands. They have no idea who I am. Oliver Stone wrote the screenplay to the movie, and in the courtroom scene in the movie, he's got me, my character Brad, saying, you're a nation of pigs, I blank your sons, I blank your daughter. Terrible, nasty stuff. And really stupid, because if you're a guy in a prison in a country where you're going to spend the next 30 years, you don't tell them, I'm going to blank your sons and daughters, because you got to go back in the jail. What I said was, you know, I've been in jail for 3.5 years. Laws change from one country to another, one time period to another. If you're going to sentence me to more prison, I can't agree with you. All I can do is forgive you. That's the other end of blank your sons and daughters.
It is pretty much the opposite.
It is the opposite. The courtroom, the judge himself, I mean, that's where he showed me. He said, my hands are tied. He said, I wish I'd retired. This is not me. I sentenced you to 4 years. The high court is forcing me to do this. His prerogative, again, he lowered life to 30 years. Thanks, I guess. Life 30 years is the same for me. But he wanted to make a film about hope and fear And he did, and he did it well. I mean, it's a brilliant film. If it wasn't, it would have been forgotten forever. But it's still on the air, and Turks are still dealing with it. And I'm still dealing with it in questions and answers about, you know, why did they do this? Why did they do that? They made a lot of decisions based upon economics. And then as an artist, Alan did the best he could. I've heard him afterwards saying that he wished maybe he'd should have put a couple of good Turks in, like the good German, as he said, you know, Fritz, the good German who gives a cigarette to the prisoner. He said, but that seemed really just tokenism, and I didn't want to do it. He said, maybe I was a little politically naive in not realizing the full brunt that this film was going to put upon Turkey, but is what it is. Mm-hmm. One of the main reasons why Sally Sussman Marina wrote and directed the documentary that she's done, it's called Midnight Return, the mm-hmm. story of Billy Hayes in Turkey, great. Is because she wanted to, when I told her I wanted to go back and explain why, she thought this would be a very interesting
documentary. So you tell us, why did you want to go back?
Because, again, it was the city of my boyhood dreams. Everybody, I was a hated man in Turkey, mostly for that courtroom speech. I found out afterwards. When you're in the audience and you're with the protagonist, you're with my character, you're screaming and yelling at the Turks. The audience is doing that. It incensed the audience against the Turks because mm-hmm. of what they did to me. And it incensed the Turks against me because they heard my character screaming, "You're a nation of pigs and I blank your sons and daughters." And that's the point. I didn't have an Interpol warrant issued for my arrest when I escaped or when my first book, Midnight Express, came out. But when the Turks saw that scene in a movie, they issued a warrant that stood for the next 20 years.
And so you wanted to correct that.
And I wanted to correct that. And I did not want a whole nation of people hating me, especially because I think they hated me. I wanted to heal the breach between us somehow. And I knew if I could get back there and talk to them like I'm talking to you, like I've talked to Turks out in public one-on-one, they say, "Well, we didn't realize that." It's like, "No, I know you didn't." Well, the documentary talks about all that stuff in detail about how and why. They've got the filmmakers' points of view. You hear them saying why they did this, and you hear me saying why I wish they. So the doc was a valuable thing, but to make a documentary work, we had to go back to Istanbul. We tried. We put down, strangely enough, I'm an escaped convict with an Interpol warrant, and we wanted to go back, and they wouldn't let me in. They didn't want any more bad publicity out of right. Billy Hayes. They wouldn't let me back. We actually had Ahmet Erdogan, who was mm-hmm. probably the wealthiest and best-known Turk of the day. You know, he ran Atlantic Records,
right.
Ray Charles, the Rolling Stones. He knew everybody. Ahmet, I had a mutual friend who knew him. And when she heard that we were trying to get back to Turkey and they wouldn't let us in, she introduced me to Ahmet. And I met him and his wife, and we talked and we spent some time. And he said, "Bring your cameras." And we went back, and he and I filmed an interview talking together. And he said, "I'm going to take this interview. I'm going to put it on TV in Turkey," which wouldn't be a problem since he owned all the TV stations.
Wow.
He said, "I'm going to put it on TV, and they will realize, as I do, your feelings towards Turkey, and we'll bring you back." And it's like, wow. Great. And 2 months later, Ahmet tripped over a cable at a Rolling Stones concert in New York, fell down, hit his head, went into a coma, and died.
Wow.
So our hopes were gone. And that's the point where I pretty much gave up the idea of going back to Turkey, because we've been trying for years, literally. And it's in the doc. You see the yeah. ups and downs. But I just, it's like, it's not going to happen now. And then out of the blue, I got a phone call from a guy who said he was Turkish. And he said he was with the Turkish National Police, and they wanted to bring me back to Istanbul. He said, "I've been looking at YouTube and seeing, you know, everything's on YouTube now, seeing videos where you said you would like to go back to Turkey and you wish that the film had been more accurate. So we want to bring you back." My first thought is, this is some of my college friends. Somebody's messing with me.
I thought you were going to think, this is a setup. They want to bring me back and throw me in jail.
No, I didn't think that. I thought it was some college friend just messing with me. So I started talking Turkish with him and realized he's really a Turk. Turns out he's in L.A. We met an hour later at a Starbucks, where everybody meets now. And he came with his wife, lovely lady. She had her thing on, covered, and beautiful lady. She shook my hand very casually, and she just sat there and didn't say a word for the next hour and just watched me. And I was really aware of this, like, antenna picking mm-hmm. up. And he and I talked back and forth, and he told me what they wanted to do. And she just watched me. At the end of the interview, he and I shook hands, and she actually shook my hand and took my hand. And I felt like I just passed the test somewhere.
Right.
And I did, because if she didn't think I was honest about, you know, I told him what I wanted, which is to talk about the truth about my situation.
Right.
And months and months and months went by and nothing happened. Then out of the blue, one Friday afternoon, I got a phone call saying, "It's all set. Go to Pan Am, pick up your tickets. Monday, you fly to Turkey." It's like, whoa! And Sally and Tony had to get their own ticket. The Turkish National Police brought me back. There was an international conference going on, a peace and global democracy. And the world press was going to be there, and these cops knew the best thing for them would be have Billy Hayes there in Istanbul with the world press to hear him saying what I've been saying
right.
to some degree here. As they told me later on, they said, the best thing for us is images of you walking down the streets free in Istanbul. Worst thing is images walking down the street free and having somebody shoot you in the head because you're still a hated man. So it had to be done very quietly, undercover. But I got a chance to, I was in a room with 1,000 policemen from 63 countries, at this conference, and they took some pictures, and somebody said, "You look very sheepish sitting in there." It's like, I'm in a room in Istanbul with 1,000 cops. I was feeling very sheepish indeed. But I got a chance to talk to the Turkish press and Turkish TV, and it was wonderful. I mean, it changed everything.
Awesome.
By the time I got back to the hotel, there were some people in the hotel room who said, "We just saw you on TV. Thank you so much for telling the truth about your movie and about, you know, it hurt Turkey so much, your movie." I said, "I understand. I feel bad." Wow. He said, "No, they hear you." And it changed everything. And they actually let me, the police, who were very concerned about us for the first 2 days until we got to do the press conference, and because they could have lost their jobs, these guys, for bringing me back. If something went bad.
Well, they knew it was the right thing.
They did know it was the right thing. And they had the nuts to stand up and do it. And it turned out very good for them, very good for us. I got to, because we offered them what they wanted, and I got to do the conference, they got us, the filmmakers, what we wanted, which was to go back out to Bakırköy.
Wow.
They took me.
In a rowboat?
No. I always wanted to go back to Istanbul, but I never thought I would go back to Bakırköy. They closed Bakırköy about 15 years ago. This was 2007, so 15 years before that. They literally locked it up. It was old, run down, decrepit. It was horrible conditions.
Still open?
The hospital, the huge hospital ground was open. That section 13 that I was in, that's what they closed. And they brought all of the madmen into another facility, much nicer, upgraded their treatment of, I say madmen, it's a tough term, but that's what it was. It was like insane people. Mm-hmm. But they just locked the door, padlocked it, and went away. And nobody was ever went back in there until we showed up 15 years later. They had to, like, the old creaky lock. Yeah. They had to, like, push the door open. And I got to walk in across the dirt ground, and they were filming me. Sally was there. That, again, I never thought I'd be back to Bakırköy. I got to walk in, and the tables, some of the wooden tables had plates and things on them, totally covered with dust. There were spoons. People just locked up and walked away.
Wow.
And sunlight coming in through some broken boards in the windows, and I got to walk down those stairs back down to the basement of Bakırköy, which is where that wheel in the movie, they've got that walking around the wheel, which everybody said, well, they made that up. No, they didn't have to make anything up. And I got to walk around that wheel again, which was such a bizarre feeling.
Did you go the opposite direction?
I walked in the opposite direction, just a little bit. Just
I
to
thought
play
maybe
with it.
You did, yeah.
I had to get at it. I said, "You know, I'm done." She said, "No, wait." I said, "No, I'm done. You can talk to me outside." And I literally ran out of the room, ran up the stairs, went out of the actual section. My cops who were with us, they had the car up there, and they were all sitting on the car smoking. They saw me like come out the doors. The look on my face, they were all like, "Yeah, we kind of knew that was going to go on."
It sounds like a powerful and disturbing documentary. I think. I can't wait to see it.
We're looking for a distributor. We've been to a lot of film festivals. The film just aired in Istanbul at the Istanbul Film Festival on the 20th and the 26th of February, and with some interesting response. But we haven't picked up a distributor yet. You know, the documentaries, there's just no money in them.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk a little bit.
We'll see how that
about
works.
That.
Yeah.
Okay, but. And the name of it is, again?
Midnight Return, the story of Billy Hayes in Turkey. Actually, Sally wanted to show how the power of film, and they took my story to show how powerful a film can be and how it affected governments and countries and individuals and so on. And she's done a really good job on it. I'm very lucky to have her do this.
And just can you tell us a little bit about how the different depictions of your life in prison, how accurate was that? How is it even possible to capture that feeling?
My pat answer to this has always been, no matter how well they do or don't do, I mean, the film was 2 hours. I was in jail for 5 years. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can understand time. You can't. I don't care how good the movie is. You get up and you walk out. Maybe it lingers with you. Maybe it stays with you. But it's 2 hours and you're done. 5 years is a long time. A long time. Which is why when I hear people who, you know, do 10 and 15 and 20 years in jail, it breaks my mind. Yeah? Because at five, I was... Whew.
So I understand that now you actually do sort of a one-man show. You're doing a tour. Can you tell us about that?
I've been writing The Midnight Express with Billy Hayes. If we're going to promote it, let's promote the shit out of it. And it's been a joy. I've been doing it about almost 4 years now around the world. my friends kept saying, you know, you're an actor, you're a director, you're a writer. Why don't you do, you know, your real story? And, oh, we did the book, we did the movie. No, why don't you tell? And then they would, you know, we go to a party and they'd get me smoking some pot and I'd start telling all these stories. And one day I realized and I started writing it. And once I got into it, I realized I do want to do this. That's I've done awesome. This hundreds and hundreds of times now. And I love to do it. I absolutely love doing it. This show allows me to be all that I am and to give whatever I have to offer. And that's just a treat for me. And I'm so appreciative of having an audience who they keep wanting to hear it.
Well, I'm so appreciative of sitting here and getting to know you a little bit, Billy. And
Thank you.
So happy that you got the opportunity to tell your story and the true story and the full true story.
Yeah.
Because that's the life you lived. And those details and those important moments that can't be squeezed into a production are really revealing. And it does really speak about your courage.
I wrote the whole show for a variety of reasons, but really, I wanted to get to the one central part of the show that I wanted to speak about because it's never really told, which is I discovered in prison my reason for being again, which is simply to love. And I never realized that. And it took me to be down in the depths of a Turkish prison somewhere to realize that's why I exist. And as long as I'm doing that, everything else, you know, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. One-on-one to whoever I'm sitting with or as far as I can spread it, because if I listen to my heart, that does me well. And I get a chance to talk about that, literally where that realization and how that came to me in the play. And I do the whole play for that reason. I've had people say, yeah, that's what I discovered. You know, that's the only truth I know. And it's like, oh, that's so reinforcing and
life-affirming.
Life-affirming. Yeah, that's the word, life-affirming. And it's the best thing I have to offer. And when people respond to it, that's so gratifying.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, it's been an incredible pleasure for me to sit here and get to know you. And I really appreciate you coming out and
talking to us. Thank you so much for having me in.
Being so open. And I hope that you continue to tell your story. And I hope that you continue at the end of each iteration of it, that you get more revelations and you get to keep folding them in, because as you probably have learned, life is a journey and there are a lot of twists and turns in that journey, but I'm glad you're here to talk about
too.
It.
Me too.
And I just want to thank the listeners for being a part of this very special interview episode of Locked Up Abroad, and hopefully we'll talk to you again, Billy.
Indeed.
It was great.
Down the line.
You.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.